Ralph Schoen,
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, October 11th, 2005. We have a remarkable program for you today, a unique opportunity. We have in the studio with us author Joan Mellon. Her book, soon to be released, is A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. It will be published by Potomac Books and with a release date in November. Now, Jim Garrison's prosecution of Clay Shaw and his investigation of the JFK assassination was the case that should have changed history. And in fact, Joan Mellon's compelling book and her investigation over 7 years will change history. Hi, Joan. Are you there?
Hi, Maya.
Hello, Joan.
Hi, Ralph.
Let's start by saying a little bit about who Joan is. Joan Mellon, Temple University professor and author, is well known for her biographies of Lillian Hellman and Dashiell Hammett, Kay Boyle, her film criticism and filmography of Marilyn Monroe and The Battle of Algiers, and many Japanese filmmakers and movies, and also a biography of Bob Knight, one that is outside the realm of the usual sports biography. Joan is the author of 17 books and countless articles that have appeared in the Baltimore Sun, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and Philadelphia Inquirer. She's been a professor at Temple University, particularly one of the creators of the Creative Writing Program, and in 2004 was awarded the Most Coveted Great Teacher Award for her outstanding achievement, particularly in the Graduate Writing Program. Ralph?
Well, Joan has, as well, Maya, written a very important investigative book called Privilege, which is an investigation of the death of Sasha Bruce, who was the daughter of David K. E. Bruce, who was the U.S. ambassador to Great Britain and one of the key figures in the OSS, the predecessor of the Central Intelligence Agency. But with respect to A Farewell to Justice, let me say to you that A Farewell to Justice, in my judgment, is far and away the most significant document and investigative work ever to emerge with respect to the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And I speak from some experience here, because I have to say to you, brothers and sisters, that as many of you are aware, my work with Bertrand Russell entailed the formation of the Who Killed Kennedy Committee in early 1964. We brought Mark Lane to London. Rush to Judgment was written in my flat in London. We indeed were engaged in this effort, and I can tell you from experience, and that includes an acquaintance and involvement with Jim Garrison, that nowhere has there appeared a book as devastating in its documentation, an exhaustive purvey of witnesses, and its involvement with the very plug-ugly contract killers, the people who were not just involved in discussing the assassination, but in implementing it, the coordinates. These are the people who Joan ferreted out and has nailed. I am convinced that for decades, this is going to be a benchmark book, and its evidence and its documentation and its witnesses perused, studied, and the implications are no longer implications. It's right there. The head of the intelligence services, the Central Intelligence Agency, and military intelligence are the authors of the execution of the President of the United States.
Over the next 3 hours, we'll be discussing with Joan the most remarkable investigation yet. Joan, what was the motivation and why did you begin the reinvestigation of the Jim Garrison inquiry into the John F. Kennedy assassination?
Maya, I began writing a biography of Jim Garrison. I was a biographer, and I thought he was an interesting person whom I had known. And I thought I would talk about his handling of the office of the district attorney in Orleans Parish. By the time I was into it for, I don't know, some months, I realized that this was going to be a book about his investigation, a biography of his investigation. And after that, I realized, too, that his investigation went only so far, and it was only after the passage of the JFK Act in 1992 that voluminous documents were issued by the FBI and CIA and became available in the National Archives, and that these documents had much to say about the investigation begun by Jim Garrison in the 1960s. So my book really begins as a biography of Jim Garrison, then becomes a biography of his investigation, and finally is an investigation of my own. And I found witnesses whom Garrison knew about, but who never really were forthcoming in their discussions with Garrison, and finally revealed what they knew only at the very end when I saw them. In fact, I did the last interview for this book in June of 2005 in Miami because I wasn't satisfied with the explanations for why Bobby Kennedy opposed Jim Garrison's investigation so strongly.
We're going to be going more into the particulars of Bobby Kennedy and his interference with the Garrison investigation in the second hour. But right now, let's look a bit more at what the structure of the Garrison investigation was and how you actually peeled away all the layers and then were able to substantiate what he had found and then went even deeper so that you actually got to the core of the relationships that showed that Oswald was not a lone assassin, that in fact Oswald, Clay Shaw, David Ferry, and many others were involved in the conspiracy to assassinate John F. Kennedy.
Joan?
Yes, sir.
Yes, well, we were, that was a question, I think, but in any event, the question here, I think, has to do with what allowed you to reprise Jim's investigation and to take it to the places where he could not go.
Notably, how did I do it? In other words, how did I do it?
How did you do it? And, of course, you know, a huge array of data and evidence wasn't available to Jim during his lifetime. But then the actual ferreting out of witnesses and the interviewing of those witnesses and inducing them to come forward and to acknowledge the relationships, the planning of the assassination and its implementation, that is your work. Building on Jim Garrison, though it may be, I have to say that, and I speak here as someone who is experienced in this, I have never seen anything like this. Please expatiate a bit.
Okay, Ralph. Well, I was, as you were talking, I was thinking of one particular witness who enabled me to see Lee Harvey Oswald's role and that he was involved with people who were involved with U.S. Customs, for example. And I was driving down the roads of Louisiana searching for anyone who had been involved with Garrison's investigation, who knew Clay Shaw. And I was driving in Bogalusa where I met one of Clay Shaw's friends. And this friend said, he said what he had to say, and then he said, you know, you really should talk to my wife. And his wife came out and said, you know, I had gone to junior high school with Lee Harvey Oswald. And so when he knocked on my door one day and said, does Juan live here? I knew exactly who he was. They had gone to the same junior high, and she remembered him well. She called him Harvey. And it turned out that her neighbor was a man named Juan Valdez, who later would be the chief suspect in the murder of a doctor named Mary Sherman, who was, we think, was involved with one of Garrison's chief suspects, David Ferry. And so I learned about Oswald's relationship with Juan completely inadvertently. In another example, I got the information about how Oswald, Clay Shaw, and David Ferry traveled together to Clinton and Jackson in a very mysterious way, but with this very association of Oswald with Shaw pointed to the fact that the cover-up of the assassination had begun even before the shooting in Dallas. Well, I traveled across that ferry from St. Francisville over the Mississippi River, terrified because it seemed to me as if that raft were about to sink and you had your car on it. And I drove to Eunice, Louisiana, and I met one of Garrison's investigators named Ann Dischler. And Mrs. Dischler didn't want, when I finally got there, she didn't want to show me her notes because she felt that she had been betrayed by a previous author who wrote a book denying what was actually in the notes, which she had seen the notes. And 2 years later, I found myself driving through a monsoon over the Atchafalaya Swamp back to Mrs. Dischler's house, where she sat with me for days, not only showing me the notebooks, but also discussing each page and all her memories of the, because the book was somewhat in shorthand, very quickly written. And so I learned about that very important trip that Oswald took with Ferry and Shaw up to Clinton and Jackson, where Oswald applied for a job at East, which is the East Louisiana State Hospital at Jackson, and where I later learned, and this Jim Garrison never knew, actually through a doctor named Dr. Frank Silva, that Oswald did indeed apply for a job at that hospital, And this was an incident Jim Garrison knew about, but which some people have denied ever happened. But I certainly knew it did happen because Dr. Frank Silver was the medical director of the hospital during the summer of 1963. And he saw Oswald in a very different mode from the Oswald who stood on Canal Street and handed out leaflets supporting Fair Play for Cuba and was supposedly pro-Castro. Because what Oswald did when he was at the East Louisiana State Hospital at Jackson was talk about how he was going to kill Castro. And there I learned that Oswald was indeed there, and that Oswald somehow believed that his function was going to be to kill Fidel Castro, not to kill John F. Kennedy.
Well, in this regard, I think we need to explain to our listeners just the significance of the placing of Shaw and Lee Harvey Oswald and I believe Guy Bannister together in the same place, conspiring, as it were, to position Oswald in certain key respects. But perhaps we should elucidate, Joan, the Central Intelligence Agency relationship of Clay Shaw and indeed of Oswald and of David Ferry, the key figures that we're discussing here.
Okay, well, let's talk about Clay Shaw first. Clay Shaw was the man whom Garrison indicted for participation in the conspiracy to murder John F. Kennedy. And when we look at Clay Shaw's background, what we find is that he rose very rapidly in the army, although he never actually appeared on the field of battle. And it was clear that he worked with military intelligence during the war, during the Second World War. When he returned to New Orleans, he was from Kentwood, Louisiana, although he wrote on his CIA file, his application or whatever, the CIA file says that he was born in New Orleans, and that's what Shaw said when he was arrested. In fact, he was born in a town called Kentwood, and he came back to New Orleans and immediately joined something called Mississippi Shipping. Well, Mississippi Shipping was a CIA proprietary in New Orleans. And from there, Shaw joined the International Trade Mart, where ultimately he became its managing director. And the International Trade Mart in New Orleans was a CIA project, as were several other such trademarts that were enacted by the CIA. It was particularly important in New Orleans, which was a port and heavily infiltrated by the CIA. Shaw then really was very grateful to the CIA for promoting him. He actually was a high school dropout, never had studied economics, didn't know anything about trade, yet was the managing director of this huge international trade mart. And so I think Garrison thought, when the CIA called Shaw and asked him to look after Oswald in the state of Louisiana, Shaw could not help but agree to do it. It's not that Shaw had anything really, that he had a desire to murder John F. Kennedy, but rather that he was fulfilling an assignment and a repayment for what the CIA had done for him. You could see some traces of Shaw's relationship with the CIA when one of Garrison's investigators, actually an assistant district attorney named Richard Burns, one day telephoned Clay Shaw at home, and he said, "Is John Shaw there?" And Shaw was suspicious, and he said, "Who sent you?" Which is not the sort of thing you would say to someone calling up whom you don't know who sent you, but Shaw was obviously accustomed to receiving such telephone calls. The key piece of evidence that Garrison developed about Shaw really had to do with a meeting that took place at the home of David Ferry. So I'll say a couple of words about Ferry. Ferry was a disgraced Eastern Airlines pilot, and he was disgraced not because of anything he did politically, but because he committed what in New Orleans at the time were called crimes against nature. And in particular, his involvement with young boys and they're running away from home and coming to him and all of this. And David Ferry was a CIA contract pilot who flew missions into Cuba, burning the sugarcane fields, exfiltrating people, infiltrating other people. And around him, he had a group of young boys who had joined something called the Civil Air Patrol, which Ferry led. And among those boys was Lee Harvey Oswald. So a relationship existed between Lee Harvey Oswald and David Ferry dating from the 1950s, before Oswald joined the Marines. So now we're coming to the late September, perhaps, of 1963. At a party at David Ferry's house called a gathering, we see Clay Shaw. Lee Harvey Oswald is present during that evening, only he's called Leon, which he was on several occasions in this story. And they're discussing the assassination of President Kennedy. In particular, Shaw and David Ferry are discussing what their alibis would be for November 22, 1963. And they're doing this in the hearing of a young man named Perry Russo, who was one of David Ferry's acolytes, perhaps, and is sitting there listening. And eventually, only after David Ferry died, under mysterious circumstances. It's really not clear of what he died, but he died on February 22nd, 1967. And the following week, Harry Russo came forward and wanted to tell his story to the sheriff in Baton Rouge. And the sheriff's office in Baton Rouge didn't want to hear it. And they said, go to the newspapers. And so Perry Russo went to a Baton Rouge newspaper and told about David Ferry. He didn't talk about Shaw at that moment, but he did talk about Ferry. And Garrison's investigators in New Orleans read the newspaper. And Mumu Chambra, who was one of Garrison's people, drove up to Baton Rouge the next day to talk to Perry Russo. And it was then, on that Saturday, that Perry Russo told Andrew Chambra about the party at David Ferry's in which Ferry and Clay Shaw discussed what their alibis would be for the day of the assassination. These alibis turned out to be true. David Ferry was in Hammond at Southeast Louisiana University, and Clay Shaw was in San Francisco during the assassination. So both of them found it turned out to be true. Garrison immediately had Perry Russo take sodium pentothal to see if he was telling the truth. Really, they did that. They knew the evidence, and they did that just to check. And Russo said the same things. Before the sodium pentothal test, and this was something that I discovered, Perry Russo sat before a police artist, and he described the people that he saw at David Ferry's apartment. In particular, he described the man who called himself Clem Bertrand, and Clay Bertrand was the alias of Clay Shaw. And as Perry Russo described this person, the artist, was a police officer, drew the picture, and it turned out to be an exact likeness of Clay Shaw. Now, you might wonder whether that police artist who has come forward here for the first time was telling the truth. But the fact that he turns out to be the person to whom my book is dedicated, a New Orleans police officer who first walked the beat on Bourbon Street, later was part of New Orleans police intelligence, still later was one of the members of Team 3, the Louisiana investigators who worked for the United States for the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and a police officer of impeccable record named Robert Buras. And Robert Buras, his ambition in life was to be an artist, but because he grew up in the projects and was poor and his dad was an alcoholic and he had nothing, he had to become a policeman. But it wasn't what he actually wanted to be an artist. And so he is the person who drew that likeness of Clay Shaw.
Well, Joan, this is incredibly important, and you have a chapter in your book called An Operative in Action, which details the intelligence role of Clay Shaw. And in it, you quote Clay Shaw at a press conference on March 2nd of 1967, the day after Jim Garrison arrested him, that Clay Shaw said explicitly, "I did not know Harvey Lee Oswald," referring to Lee Harvey Oswald, "and that he had never met Mr. Dave Ferry." And here you have tied them all together. Not only that, you go into Shaw's recruiting of Guy Bannister, of whom I'd like you to speak also, in a program called, is it Kenchant?
QK and Chant.
It's QKENCHANT. And then also you uncovered that Clay Shaw was not just a CIA employee, that he was particularly an agent, and you have John Witten, a longtime officer in clandestine services, in charge of reviewing counterintelligence operations. You have him discussing actually the files of Clay Shaw, even though these files were purged. And if I can read from your book, on page 143, it says, "Far from being a mere asset for the domestic contact service, Clay Shaw was a CIA operative. His records resided with counterintelligence, Arthur Dooley of the counterintelligence research and analysis staff, headed by Raymond Roker, nicknamed The Rock, by Chief James Angleton. One day telephoned John P. Dempsey, the director of research. Dooley revealed how well aware he was of Clay Laverne Shaw. He did not bother with the fantasy of attaching an ending date to Clay Shaw's counterintelligence service." Remarkable. Remarkable research.
Joan, with respect to the Central Intelligence Agency high-level role of Clay Shaw over a substantial period of time, we also have the evidence concerning the CIA history of Lee Harvey Oswald at Tsugi Air Force Base and with his false defection to the Soviet Union and with his subsequent return. run by the CIA, FBI, and so on.
Well, let me just mention one point, because you said so many things. We have to get back to who Guy Bannister was as well. But one of the points that I think is worth making is that Fair Play for Cuba itself was heavily infiltrated by the CIA, and in particular was a project of the propaganda specialist David Atlee Phillips. So it was no accident that Oswald was standing there on Canal Street and also in front of the International Trademark, where Clay Shaw were giving out his leaflets for Fair Play for Cuba. And I also want to mention that although it was known, I think I prove without any doubt that Oswald was working for more than one agency, for working for United States Customs, and those files, let me add right here, have not been opened, although it would seem that at the National Archives we have all the records of the Church Committee and the House Select Committee on Assassinations. In fact, all of the records at the Church Committee would show that Oswald was working closely with U.S. Customs still remain sealed to this day. However, the summaries exist, and that's where I got the information, because the summaries of those interviews can be found at the National Archives.
By agencies, you're referring to the CIA, the FBI, and the U.S. Customs.
Now, yes, and yes, Maya. Now, as far as the FBI is concerned, the Warren Commission knew about that, and that was how Jim Garrison started on his investigation. And I think it's interesting to mention that throughout his life, including in his books, Garrison always said that it was Russell Long, Senator Russell Long, who was the son of the Huey Long, who first got him on to investigating the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And this wasn't true at all. In fact, the person who inspired Jim Garrison, and Garrison kept this secret because he didn't want to blow his cover, was Louisiana Representative Hale Boggs. Hale Boggs was a member of the Warren Commission, and Hale Boggs was present during one of the closed sessions of the Warren Commission at which FBI records of Lee Harvey Oswald were discussed. And Alan Dulles, who was also on the Warren Commission, the CIA director whom John F. Kennedy had fired, had told all the Warren commissioners that this, none of this must ever leave the room. And, of course, the first thing that Hale Boggs did was to tell Jim Garrison about Oswald's connection to the FBI. And hearing that, Garrison realized that the investigation that he had begun in 1963 when he questioned David Ferry during the weekend of the assassination turned out to be something that the Warren Commission had not investigated at all, and that he really should resume his investigation. One of the people whom I interviewed at great length was the FBI clerk, William Walter. And I think he's one of the most important witnesses. He was deposed before the House Select Committee, who tried to discredit him at every turn. And I think that William Walter stood up well under that questioning. And I think he's an entirely credible witness. William Walter was a young Tulane student in 1963. And during the summer, when Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested on Canal Street for a skirmish that he had with members of a Cuban organization called DRE, which was the Directorate of Students, Oswald was arrested and taken to jail, where he was questioned by Lieutenant Francis Martello. And Oswald told Lieutenant Martello, call the FBI and tell them that you have Lee Harvey Oswald here. Actually, I think he said Lee Oswald. Now, Martello never talked about this, and he only did so many, many years later in the 1990s. Well, Martello telephoned the FBI. The person who answered the telephone was William Walter. And William Walter, it was, I guess, late at night, maybe on the weekend, and there was only one FBI agent present. His name was John Quigley. And Quigley immediately told Walter to see if they had any files on Lee Harvey Oswald. And, of course, the place was filled with files, including a file that was in the sealed filing cabinet of the special agent in charge down there. And there it became clear that Lee Harvey Oswald was part of FBI operations in New Orleans. This was a security file that was kept in a locked cabinet. There were also informant files. And on the jacket of Lee Harvey Oswald's security file was the name of a very well-known FBI agent down there in New Orleans called Warren DeBruys, who until this day, and I've spoken to him maybe 2 months ago, denies that he ever knew Oswald, although he did say to me something that he never said before. What he said was, you know, I wouldn't be a very intelligent man if I never changed my mind. And I'll take that as an admission by Warren DeBruys, because otherwise he was the toughest. Although he was not the special agent in charge, he was the toughest of the FBI agents down there. Anyway, there's Oswald's relationship with the FBI, spelled out beyond a doubt. The CIA records do not reveal that Oswald was part of the false defector program that went into the Soviet Union, but it was pretty clear that he was. All the evidence points to that.
Well, let's take a moment to look at the intelligence relationships here. The Fair Play for Cuba Committee at the time was a one-person operation, Lee Harvey Oswald, but it was operating out of a particular location. And it was a building that had offices of somebody named Guy Bannister, which was a clearinghouse for intelligence operations. You have here a convergence of Guy Bannister, Lee Harvey Oswald, David Ferry, Clay Shaw, and in various circumstances, Jack Ruby as well. The convergence of the central figures in the planning and implementation of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Would you expand upon your own documentation of this with witnesses and documents?
Well, first, I think we have to tell the audience who Guy Bannister was. Guy Bannister had been the special agent in charge of the FBI office in Chicago, which, of course, was the mafia stronghold. He came to New Orleans where, as a cover, he joined the police department and became, and I can't recall his exact title, but he got into a drunken rage once in a bar and he took out his gun and whatnot, and he was fired from the police department. He ran what was supposedly a detective agency at 531 Lafayette Street. And the side entrance of that building, now the United States Courthouse at 500 Camp Street, but the side entrance is 544 Camp Street. And Lee Harvey Oswald stamped 544 Camp Street on some of the leaflets that he gave out in the, for Fair Play for Cuba. And this created quite a disturbance. When Jim Garrison started his investigation, he took note of that. And it was Garrison sitting in his office one day with several Cubans who were helping him who said, wait a minute, what number camp? What number camp? And we have this on tape because the district attorney's office taped that session. And then Garrison realized that Oswald actually was operating out of the offices of Guy Bannister. Guy Bannister was in close touch with the FBI, with the CIA. He sent jeeps to Cuba. He was involved in anti-Castro activities. He was involved in collecting ammunition for an invasion of Cuba. He was involved in supplying money from the CIA to the training camps, training Cuban exiles to invade Cuba north of Lake Pontchartrain. All these names are so familiar now, aren't they? And Oswald had an office on the second floor of Bannister's office. And Bannister also had files on everybody, anti-communist files. And one of the young men who was a spy for Bannister and infiltrating left-wing organizations noticed Oswald on the street. Noticed first Oswald in Bannister's office, then noticed Oswald in the street giving out pro-Castro leaflets. And he said, well, you know, what's going on here? And Bannister said, and I think Garrison did discover that well, he's one of us. Don't worry about him. He's one of us. So it's fairly clear that Oswald was connected with these agencies. Bannister was connected with these agencies. Both were connected with the plots that the CIA had been running to murder Fidel Castro. I don't know how far we should go with that. Now, Garrison began his investigation with a character, a New Orleans character named Jack Martin. And Jack Martin was working part-time with Guy Bannister. Jack Martin, therefore, knew David Ferry, and he knew that Oswald was seen in Guy Bannister's office. And so when President Kennedy was assassinated, Jack Martin started telling everyone in New Orleans, wait a minute, David Ferry, who was a resident here in New Orleans, knew Lee Harvey Oswald, the killer of President Kennedy, very well. And that started Jim Garrison's investigation in 1963. Now, when Garrison resumed his investigation in 1966 and 1967, one of the first people he called in was Jack Martin. And I think if the people who have seen the movie JFK, they'll remember Jack Martin was played by Jack Lemmon, and they might remember the scene in which Guy Bannister pistol whips Jack Martin for something, for stealing a file from his office, which turns out to have been true and may very well have been the Lee Harvey Oswald file that Guy Bannister had kept. One of the discoveries that I made, and I want to give thanks to one of the people who helped me find these documents, whose name is Malcolm Blunt and who lives in England, one of the documents that I found was that document in which Bannister is recruited by QK and Chant. Now, QK and Chant was a CIA project, and it permitted a CIA asset or employee to recruit other people who were not part of the CIA for CIA projects. Many people who have defended Clay Shaw have said, oh, well, QK and Chant was just something about debriefing people, debriefing businessmen, and that really isn't true. It was a project that involved CIA operatives who were given the authority to recruit people who were not part of the agency.
Well, Joan, you have August 1960 that Shaw is recruiting a Guy Bannister. And you write, a recently uncovered secret CIA document reveals that Guy Bannister Associates was of interest to the agency for QK and Chant purposes.
Now, let me interrupt you a minute, Meyer. I forgot to mention, there's so much material to cover, and that is that it required some effort to prove that Clay Shaw knew Guy Bannister, that these were people who were part of the same operation. Now, I have a witness named Alan Campbell who worked for Guy Bannister who told me that, of course, Guy Bannister used to meet with Clay Shaw frequently. But the significance of that document is if Guy Bannister were, in fact, recruited for QK and Chant, well, the only member of QK and Chant in New Orleans was Clay Shaw. So there we have the connection between Guy Bannister and Clay Shaw confirmed by a second, well, by a document itself.
Today, we're speaking with author Joan Mellon, investigator Joan Mellon, who has prepared the most incredible, compelling book, A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. This is the first interview with Joan for the release of her book. WBAI is very fortunate today to have Joan with us here in the studio. Ralph?
Well, I want to emphasize here, because we've been dwelling on some of the particulars, and the particulars are of great significance, not only because key witnesses come forward and Joan has unearthed the corroborating documents. She's ferreted them out. She's got them out of people who had been hoarding them and hiding them. She solicited them and covered them from files that had not been labeled as such. But let's put this in its larger context, brothers and sisters. Clay Shaw, CIA. Lee Harvey Oswald, CIA. David Ferry, CIA. Guy Bannister, CIA. Jack Ruby, FBI and CIA. They're not just a team on their own. As Joan's book elucidates and as her documentation and her interviews and her time spent with the actual culprits makes clear, we're talking about the top echelons of the Central Intelligence Agency and of military intelligence. David Atlee Phillips, the head of station throughout Latin America. Richard Helms, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency himself, James Jesus Angleton, the head of counterintelligence and with the Defense Intelligence Agency. All of this emerges from this book irrefutably with overwhelming documentation. It's not just a vindication of Jim Garrison, but it's the documentation beyond any question of the treason at the top that the Kennedy execution represents. This is an extraordinary document. It's going to remain such for decades. I urge you to buy it for an extraordinary achievement, 8 years in the making, that in my judgment is the most significant investigative work that I've come across.
While we're so lucky to have Joan with us for the 3 hours today, we can only touch upon the incredible research, the remarkable detail, and there are almost 100 pages of very tiny print of notes to accompany, to let you know where exactly she got each piece of information, and every sentence is a new discovery in this book, and also the dates of her interviews. It is a remarkable scholarly work as well as an investigative tour de force. A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History, and we're telling you this is a work that will change history.
Well, let's be very clear about this, brothers and sisters. The enshrining of a coup d'etat and the execution of the head of state and the installation of the heads of the intelligence agencies and the joint chiefs and the military services in effecting the murder of the president sets the stage for the criminalization of the state and all that has followed. The 9/11 false flag, the series of incidents from the catastrophe of Katrina to the false flag of 9/11 flows from the criminalization of the state and its capture, and this is the book that sets the documentation forth without any question. It is essential. It is essential that we make this information available, that we not just make it available, but that we emphasize its significance. The book itself draws all of its appropriate conclusions. Please, this is a document that you will read 10 times and still discover new information in it. And all of the political implications are clearly drawn, without any hesitation, drawn from the evidence, drawn from the massive interviewing documentation and disclosure, revelationary disclosures, brothers and sisters. A farewell to justice. This is the Jim Garrison JFK investigation and the case that should have changed history by Joan Mellon. It is a definitive work on the Kennedy execution. Of the hundreds of books that have appeared on this subject, nothing even begins to approach the extraordinary revelations that come forward in this book that leave no question remaining as to how Kennedy was killed and who did it and why. Keep the information coming, brothers and sisters. The struggles ahead will depend upon the kind of revelations that we're able to find and to make our own by acquiring A Farewell to Justice by Joan Mellon.
I wanted to say something. Can I interrupt mine?
Oh, of course.
I first of all want to thank WBAI for the opportunity to discuss this book in such a way without any hesitation for this length of time and to explore the ideas. I can't think of any other station in the country where this would be possible. And I didn't know that you call it free speech radio, but that's certainly what it is. And I'm extremely grateful for that. I think it's extremely rare, increasingly rare. And I can't applaud WBAI enough. I'd also like to mention that there are other aspects of the social history of the United States of the 1960s in this book, as well as the discussion of the assassination of President Kennedy. One of those is the civil rights movement and the efforts of CORE, especially, it turned out, in that little town of Clinton, Louisiana, in the summer of 1963, when Lee Harvey Oswald went up there with Clay Shaw and David Ferry. It turned out that Oswald stood online to register to vote in the middle of a CORE registration drive. And that was an extremely important registration drive because in East Feliciana Parish in Louisiana, I think they only had 10 African-American voters on the rolls during that time. You couldn't vote. And here's the registrar of voters in East Feliciana Parish had a doll with a noose around its neck on his door. And he also had in his office one of those anti-civil rights movement, I don't know what to call it, the vicious posters against Martin Luther King, in which it was Martin Luther King at the communist school in Tennessee. And one of the great efforts in the state of Louisiana to avoid integration was to suggest that the civil rights movement was infiltrated by communists. And this was, and there's the registrar of voters up there in East Feliciana Parish, Henry Earl Palmer, with that poster. And the same poster appeared in the barbershop of Leah McGee, where Lee Harvey Oswald went to have a haircut on that trip up there, and ultimately became his visit to the hospital to apply for a job.
And Joan, didn't you speak to McGee?
Oh, I spoke to McGee as recently as 2 days ago. He's still alive. I also spoke, and I think a much more important person for me, was the chairman of CORE in East Feliciana Parish, a man named Corey Collins. And this is a person who was a Vietnam veteran who was not given the right to vote. And Henry Earl Palmer told Corey Collins, well, you fail. Well, why did he fail? Because he answered all the questions on the exam correctly, and you only had to answer, I think, 6 out of the 10. And so he failed for that. And he came, and then there was a period of time that elapsed before you could go back and register again, and Corey Collins went back and, of course, registered to vote. One of the things that I found out about the stereotypes that we have about the South, you know, have to be adjusted a little bit. Corey Collins was so courageous that he stood up to the Klan at every chance, and he knew where they met. They used to meet at a TV repair shop, and he'd go in there when he saw all the cars outside, so he knew the Klan was meeting, and he'd go in there just to show that he knew that they should know that he knew that the Klan was meeting. And he was extremely courageous, extremely forceful, and Corey Collins was one of the people who came down to New Orleans in February of 1969 to testify at the trial of Clay Shaw, and to show that Clay Shaw certainly had lied when he said that he didn't know Oswald, or Ferry, more to the point, Oswald, because Corey Collins was one of what was called, were called the Clinton witnesses. And what Corey Collins told me, and he never told Jim Garrison, Corey Collins worked for the post office in Baton Rouge at the time of Garrison's investigation, and as a result of his testifying for Jim Garrison, Corey Collins was fired by the United States Post Office. They had written to him on saying he had to be at work on Saturday morning when they knew he couldn't possibly get back up there in time to be at work. And he was fired, and he never told Garrison. And I said, well, why didn't you tell Garrison? And he was just so stoical, and he didn't want to bother Garrison with the fact that he'd been fired from his job because he testified at the trial of Clay Shaw. And one of the great sadnesses for me was that Corey Collins died a year ago this month, in October, and so would not ever read the book. And I call him an unsung hero, which is the title of chapter 14. And Corey Collins faced down lynch mobs, and one time they removed somebody from a jail. They were going to lynch somebody, and he got there, and he said, by the time I get there, he better be back in jail. They better leave him where he was, and they did. And later, when some of Clay Shaw's friends went up there and tried to intimidate Corey Collins' father, he exposed them, and he knew as liars, because they said that a deputy sheriff had pointed out the Collins house, and Corey Collins said, well, the deputy sheriff knew, and of course this is a racist who's used words that we won't use on WBAI today, but he said he knew that Corey Collins had told all the so-called law enforcement up there, bother me, not him, referring to his father. And I think that Emmett Collins, it was Corey Collins' father, died the previous June, and Corey Collins was on dialysis throughout the time that I knew him, and he stayed alive through that summer after his father died, and then he died himself, as I said, in October.
We should remind people the CORE is the Congress of Racial Equality, and at the time of which Joan is speaking, there were tests in the South. You had to pass a voter registration test before you could register. This was one of the great struggles to eliminate the tests and allow people to register as citizens of the United States.
But I think it's important to emphasize here that what emerges in the identifying of Oswald and Clinton and his presence there with Clay Shaw and with David Ferry is that they were running Oswald up there to take him into the mental hospital and to create the paper trail for the later setting up of Oswald as Patsy. And that the significance of this is that, as Joan elucidates in her book, they were preparing the cover story even before the execution of Kennedy himself. And
well, that's extremely important, Ralph, because it shows that if the cover-up began before the crime, then you can certainly say that the same people who did the cover-up also did the crime. And many people have tried to say, well, it's so obvious that the CIA covered up what happened in the assassination, but is it clear that they were involved in the crime? And, of course, here we see the two processes being identical.
The witnesses that established that, I mean, let's just take James Wilcox, who was with Oswald at Atsugi Air Force Base and was with the Central Intelligence Agency, and whose own testimony about Oswald's role and the role of the Central Intelligence Agency and the role that was assigned to Oswald as the fake Marxist, the Fidelista, who was the presumptive assassin that would facilitate the invasion of Cuba in the aftermath of the Kennedy execution.
I wanted to correct one small point regarding the component of the CIA that was involved in the assassination. And I think it's the people that seem to be involved here. First of all, of course, the legal offices of the CIA in Lawrence, Houston are present throughout this. But primarily it was the clandestine service and not, I would say, the several other components. For example, people in the Soviet realities section, which should have been notified about Oswald's presence in the Soviet Union and were not informed. And I think even one might question whether the clandestine service, which at that time was led by Richard Helms, he was deputy director for plans, and plans meant dirty operations or the clandestine service. It's not even clear whether John McCone, who was director of Central Intelligence at the time, was informed, and I think we know the phrase now, plausible deniability, that it would be, I think they thought, much better that he not know. And I think Helms pretty much admitted when he testified before the church committee that there was a great deal of information that they never shared with John McCone, precisely so that he could say that he didn't know about this or that, and that he really didn't know, and that he would be telling the truth. And I think it's very likely that the same was true for the Kennedy assassination itself.
Well, now, Joan, let's talk for a moment about the revelations that occurred in the Italian newspaper Paese Sera, which had been carrying out an investigation in Italy during the late 60s into the Central Intelligence Agency role in Italy in preparing the potential military putsch in Italy that did in fact occur in Greece, and in what was later disclosed to be something called Operation Gladio, the 40-year subversion of the political process in Italy and staging operations. One of the things that emerged from that series of investigative reports in Paese Sera was the proprietary company Centro Mondiale Commerciale, World Trade Mart, with a figure named Clay Shaw, and another operation of the Central Intelligence Agency called Permanent Industrial Expositions, or Permindex. As you know, I sent those materials to Jim Garrison at the time, and you and I had occasion to interview the editors and the participants in that study a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I wanted to make that point. You made it for me, but I was going to make that point, that Jim Garrison didn't have the CIA files that of Clay Shaw that we have today. But through Ralph's efforts, Ralph was in London at the time working on the Who Killed Kennedy Committee, and also was executive director of the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation. And at that time, Ralph became friendly with the Italian correspondent from Paese Sera to London named Giorgio Fanti. And through Fanti, Ralph received the series of articles that appeared in Paese Sera, which had to do with the role of the CIA in electoral politics in several countries, particularly France and Italy, after the war. And what should be written, and to the surprise of the Paese Sera editors, was that on the board of Permindex, which was the main organization, and then that CMC in Rome, was Clay Shaw. And so it had been difficult to prove, number one, that the CMC and Permindex were CIA projects, but also that Clay Shaw was enlisted by the heads of those organizations to be on the board of directors, which would be an American Central Intelligence Agency asset endorsing those activities in Europe. One of the documents that I received shows, it's a CIA document from 1948, and it showed that Ferenc Nagy, who was one of the leaders of Permindex, was and had been CIA asset since the early days of the CIA, since its inception, really, in 1947 and in 1948.
Well, aren't we talking as well here with the involvement of Guy Bannister and in the activities of Permindex and of Clay Shaw and the Centro Mondiale Commerciale, not only what led to the assassination of Kennedy, but an elaborate plan to support the fascists in France who were involved in the OAS in Algeria, Jacques Soustelle, and the planned assassination of Charles de Gaulle.
That's right. When the CIA could not influence the elections in these European countries through spending money and giving money to the political parties whom the CIA wanted to support, they supported assassination attempts. And as you say, Ralph, against de Gaulle, and certainly they were very big supporters of the OAS, which are this fascist torture organization, which you can see trying to prevent the liberation of Algeria from France, and that you see in Gillo Pontecorvo's film, The Battle of Algiers.
We're speaking with author Joan Mellon, and we're discussing her soon-to-be-released book, A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. This is a book that will change history because it elucidates and it uncovered new information that confirms without a doubt that Lee Harvey Oswald was not a loner, but a government agent who worked for the CIA, the New Orleans FBI office, and U.S. Customs, that he worked closely and connected to the CIA-sponsored anti-Castro figures in New Orleans, including Clay Shaw, of whom we've been speaking, David Ferry, and a Cuban associate of Shaw's at the International Trademark named Juan Valdez, Clay Shaw, and David Ferry, both Garrison suspects and CIA operatives, implemented the assassination. They helped frame Oswald as the murderer.
Let me point out that Joan, over the period of nearly 8 years, interviewed 1,000 people. 1,000 people. She ferreted out every last associate of the people involved in the execution of Kennedy. She not only did that, but tens of thousands of documents were searched and perused, and documents that produced snippets of information in each document, each of them explosive. This is integrated now in a seamless depiction of the unfolding of this execution and its instruction from the highest levels. Joan, talk a moment about Maurice Bishop and Lee Harvey Oswald, and who is Maurice Bishop?